Hello, everybody, and welcome to English Language Teaching Under the Covers. I'm Neil, teacher, and today I'm along with my esteemed colleague Rich and the great and powerful Patrick Jackson. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much indeed. How nice of you to introduce me in such an inaccurate fashion. Lovely to be here on this.
Neil has the best intros.
That was good. I can do that. Especially on a grey, cold, wet Irish morning, you know, you need a pick-me-up.
Yes, I can totally imagine. You need to shine on. Sorry, I'm using your own book titles there to add to the intro.
Everybody up.
Oh. So to begin, what we'd love to do is kind of have you tell your teaching story. So if you want to go all the way back to the beginning and see how you became this all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wonderful Patrick Jackson.
Well, I was thinking about that the other day, funnily enough. Mm-hmm. And I've had a very checkered career in teaching. I was looking back and I was thinking, when was the first time I did any teaching at all? And I remember at secondary school, there was a kind of a scheme where we could go down the road and help the primary school kids, that's elementary school kids, with their reading. And I suppose I was probably about 15 or 16, and I really enjoyed that. So that was the very first time I did any, I suppose you'd call, teaching. And then next thing, I found myself in Paris, and I was just kind of bumming around Europe, and I found myself in Paris, and somebody said, oh, you can make money teaching English. All you have to do is go to somewhere, where was it? Like the British Council Church or some place, or you know, the American church lobby, and put up, there's a notice board there, and if you put up a sign and just put your phone number up and you'll get somebody. So this guy got in touch with me, and so I used to go to his house, and his wife and him used to cook me this fantastic dinner, and I used to eat dinner with them, and then at the end of dinner they would give me, like, I don't know, I can't remember how much it was, you know, 100 yeah. francs or 50 francs or something. And I'd go home and I was thinking, gosh, this is fantastic. You know, yeah. I've really, you know, I've nailed this backpacking thing. And so that was, you know, my first couple of experiences of teaching. And then I did all sorts of other things in my 20s, including working on a fishing boat and running my own late night restaurant.
Wow.
And so, I mean, actually, I would say that running a restaurant is, or being a waiter is an extremely good training for being in the classroom.
Well, so anyway, I had my own aspect of interacting with people, and you know, especially if you're working for tips, you need that pleasing in the performance. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you look at your classroom of students, and if you imagine these are all customers in my restaurant, mm-hmm. And my, you know, they've all got their own individual, they've all got their own individual tastes and their own individual thing going on. You know, they're all there for different reasons possibly, and you're serving them with, you know, hopefully delicious morsels for them to, you know, improving morsel. In a pleasant and you know, attractive manner. So yeah, I think the, you know, there probably is a lot in common, whatever about the tips. And so this Japanese woman came to my restaurant, and then a few days later I went to her restaurant. She was working as a waitress in a Japanese restaurant down the road, and one thing led to another. And then we got married. and then I had enough of running a late night restaurant in Dublin. And she said, why don't we go and live in Japan for a year? Mm-hmm. So that seemed like a good idea. And so we went to Japan. And like many people, I'm sure many of your listeners, having arrived in Japan, I wasn't an engineer or a banker or anything really. Mm-hmm. So somebody said, oh, you should teach English. Actually, no, that is not true. Sorry, that's a lie, actually, because I knew I was going to go and teach English, and I did a very short TEFL course. And then I went to Japan, and then they said, where do you find a job? And they said, you look in the Japan Times Monday edition, it's full of English teaching jobs. So I opened the Japan Times Monday edition, and it was full of English teaching jobs. And there was one which said potato club. It's a potato club needs teachers. Okay. Well, I come from Ireland. I guess this is the job for me. So I went and I had an interview and trial lesson at the potato club where I taught these two, you know, there was two children, small children there. And I was put in the room with them and it was sort of, you know, there was a couple of people watching me. And I can't remember what I did, but at the end they said, you've got the job, you know, you're just right. You're perfect for us. You know, you're
just the man. Had you dealt with any young learner students? Because you talked about being in Paris, and I presume those were adults because they were cooking for you.
In Paris, I had one student, and he was an engineer or something, or a rocket scientist, or you know, he was my he was just a guy. Yeah, he wasn't this size. You know, he was full grown up. Yeah.
And the course that you did that touch on teaching kids as well?
So my two-week TEFL course, as far as I remember, had maligning them, but as far as I remember, it had no relevant content to teaching children.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Mm. Yeah, it could be wrong though. It was only 2 weeks long, so even if it had, it certainly didn't have a great compendium of.
Yeah, that's just my experience a lot with these courses. They often gear towards adults, and then, you know, like yourself, and you know, as it's happened with Rich and I, you suddenly get thrown in with the little kids, and you're like, "What? Hold on, what was this in the course?
How did this happen?"
Right, yeah. and then you have to do the young learner extension courses or whatever, and it always seems to be that way around, doesn't it? It's like you do the adults course, and then you do the YL extension course, and we were saying how these days, you know. Maybe there's some arguments to say it should be the other way around, because in most sectors, in most countries, it seems like it's the YL sector that's really, you know, that's really big at the moment and really growing. Mm-hmm. You know.
Absolutely, I 100% agree with you, and I 100% believe that I, in no sensible and professional world, should I have been allowed to teach children. Given my complete lack of training of any sort. And I think it's a fundamental, you know, and it's a fundamental problem with the industry of, you know, and I think, you know, it mightn't be a popular opinion, but the fact that there are thousands and thousands of people going into classrooms with children with very rudimentary qualifications, if any, is not good.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we've talked about this, and at some point we're probably going to do a deep dive into the whole subject around that, because it's so weird that we have, like, back home in the UK and in Canada and Ireland, we're so rigid and rightly so concerned about having a teacher that's, you know, properly qualified, you know, walking into a kid's classroom, and yet. You can get off a plane in many countries and just walk into any classroom to teach English to, you know, little kids with remarkable little, you know, in the way of qualifications and, you know.
Yeah, and you know, going back to my story, you know, that can equally be traumatizing for the kids as for the teacher.
You know, usually the teachers are usually adults, so probably able to handle it better than children. And I think, you know, there's whatever about the teaching element, there's all sorts of safe health and safety and, you know, that kind of issues as well, which, you know, I mean, we probably don't want to dwell on it too much in this interview, but especially as I was a full-on sort of, you know, example of this, you know, walking into Japan and literally within a few weeks teaching. And not only that, but being told, oh, you're such a good teacher. You know, you're so good at this. You're just brilliant. Which is also very wrong because I didn't have a slightest clue what I was doing.
Well, maybe they saw the future potential, you know.
Well,
a diamond in the rough.
Yeah, great. But yeah, that you can tell that to the parents of the children I was teaching for the first 5 years, you know. And yeah.
Okay, so you're in the Potato Club, and how did it go from there?
Well, the Potato Club was a I think they had about maybe 400 or 500 students. It was probably a very typical private English language school. Kids used to come after their regular school, and some of them were quite small. And we had 40-minute lessons, as far as I remember. It was a nice atmosphere. You know, we were treated well as teachers. There were 4 or 5 teachers, and you know, we did 5 or 6 hours of teaching each day, usually in the afternoon. So it was a lovely job. You know, I used to have the mornings off. I was given some support in creating, you know, being creative with what I was doing, and I was actually supported by, and that's how I got into sort of, I mean, I've always been sort of a scribbler and making worksheets and so on. So we started making little books.
So
this is this. I think this is the first. Wow. This is the first Potato Pal book, yeah. And it was just you know, very simple. And the kids used to color it in, and yeah, so. That support from my boss in the Potato Club got me started on that, and we did loads of them. You know, we had at the supermarket. We had in the this is a shocker. this is bad. You know, you have potatoes in the kitchen.
Are they cooking potatoes?
They're cooking a potato cake.
Oh my god.
I'll even show you this horror story. So yeah,
it starts. No.
we cut the potatoes. Yeah, we boil the potatoes, etc. And this is the worst. We mashed them. And you know, I never thought about it. And when these books were picked up by Oxford University Press, I was like, yeah, we're going to do it in the kitchen as well, because we did. You know, we sort of versioned a lot of these books. Mm-hmm. And they said, we don't think it's really appropriate to have potatoes eating other potatoes. I was like, okay.
I can imagine the whole ridiculous of that conversation, that meeting with them. Like, okay, Patrick, are you okay? You have potatoes,
yeah.
Eating them potatoes. But that's, there's a fantastic video on your YouTube channel, The Dream Come True, I think, where you talk about how you came to producing the Potato Pals with the Oxford Press, and I'll put a link below so you know people can kind of go there to your YouTube channel and kind of get the full story about how you did it. It's such a fantastic story.
Well, it was a pandemic. You know the way when everyone was in lockdown, everyone thought, okay, I'm going to go make loads of YouTube videos, and. Was one of those.
Yeah.
But yes, well, everyone's welcome to.
Yeah, go and have a look at secret. The pandemic special from Patrick Jackson. It goes deep dives into how Potato Pals came to be with sending off the brown envelopes to Oxford Press. it's a great story.
Well, in Ireland, brown envelopes has a different connotation. I don't know about where you come from, but in brown envelopes are usually given by politicians, by sort of people to local councillors or politicians with cash.
Oh, Brian.
Yeah.
So there were no brown envelopes involved in the...
So from there, you send off your brown envelopes to the Oxford Press. They pick up those books and you're into producing English language teaching materials.
Yes, it was very, very lucky, really. And it wasn't until a few years after, actually, it was, I think, about 4 or 5 years after, and I'd actually left the Potato Club and moved on to sort of junior high school and high school teaching. And I just showed the little old books to my sister, and she said, you should send these to a publisher. So that led on to, being a... And then I suddenly found myself as an Oxford University Press author, which I am always keen to impress on everybody I meet, but actually it was, it's an honor and it's a thrill to see your books being, used all over the world, which a bigger publisher is able to facilitate. And they also got me a potato.
Patrick, before you were publishing them with Oxford, how were you producing them? Were you using like local print shops or?
Well, these guys were published, they were printed round the corner by a local print shop. Yeah, I mean, but these could have been done on a photocopier actually. Or nowadays these could have been done on just any old printer. Mm. But yes, there was a guy round the corner and he used to smoke, we used to bring these. So the drawings, I didn't do these drawings, obviously. My classroom assistant, so the Potato Club had a system where the classroom assistant would stay in the classroom, obviously to make sure that the foreign giant didn't beat up the children or something, or to change nappies in that sort of situation. So Rie did all the drawings. So I used to do rough sketches and Rie did those. And then we used to take these lovely, beautiful drawings that Rhea had done around the corner to this printer who used to smoke. He used to have a sort of one of the, it was like a cartoon cigarette with bits of ash falling. It was just ash falling off, and he used to brush them sort of off the drawing. I reckon it. I think everybody should be publishing things all the time, because all you need now is a photocopier and a stapler. There's this mystique around, I got a book published. And yeah, it is a kind of a thrill. It's a thrill, of course, but you can get a book published if you have a stapler and 20 minutes. And then you can use those materials with your students immediately. So, there is no... There shouldn't be a bar to entry into producing your own materials and publishing your own books. And if you have a story of two in you, make little storybooks and try them out, because that's fun. And I think that's your creativity only really gets going when you start doing stuff. You actually do it.
Yeah.
So you sit there going, I'm going to write a really good book that's going to be published one day. Just get on and write the thing and read it to people and see how, and that will prompt the creativity and the development.
It definitely builds from that, right? And I never thought about that. You kind of have to be creative to be creative.
It's deep.
It's 1 a.m. It's 1 a.m. my end. I'll put the link so you can watch the Patrick's video, because it's a great little video and it's very inspirational for those that just, if you're an English language teacher, produce something and put it out in the world, and you never know where it's going to take you.
Sure, yeah, and especially in a world that's changing so much so quickly. And I think that there's all sorts of ways of producing all sorts of interesting content now that, really one doesn't have to rely on external or big, sort of organizations to make that happen. I mean, having said that, I do believe that a beautifully designed and well thought out course book is a very, very good basis for any teacher.
A master producer of these types of course books. We just happen to have on the show.
Really?
Yeah, I know.
Where is he?
I mean, it's just that this is definitely not down here. Not yet. let's move into that. Everybody Up is got to be one of my most favorite course books teaching from, and I've taught so many. I don't know if you've seen any other of the review videos on Team Teacher China. There's quite an extensive list. You kind of go through them over the years teaching with young kids, but Everybody Up, especially because I know you've done Shine On as well, and tell me if I'm missing anything, but I loved Everybody Up. I'll put a link in my below so you can watch the video of more detailed thoughts, but the whole design I did like, and it's, I think you've mentioned it before, but the whole idea of linking the classroom to the wider world, a lot of the English language teaching, it's just solely about teaching English, and it kind of they're often just kind of muddled together. But with the Everybody Up series, there was more linking to kind of what's going on in the wider world, what's happening, I like the whole format as well, and obviously the songs, which are drilled in my head forever. I especially love the what is it called? I don't know the titles of the song, because I like chicken. I like this.
I like ice cream.
What's this? This is.
This is juice.
Kids always love the
yeah, it's a cracker, that song. In fact, the songs really, as you say, they are very, very catchy, and we had a lot of fun with the songs, especially on the road presenting Everybody Up, because you can really get a room of hundreds of teachers. Yeah,
they're so simple as well. Yeah. I think I used Everybody Up, the actual intro song, as my warmer for such a long time as well. Because even if you don't have anything, they can say that.
The very distinguished songwriter lineup on Everybody Up. I mean, these are we have. The Everybody Up song, with the lyrics of which are everybody up, 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 everybody up, 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 everybody up, 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 everybody up, everybody up. Everybody up. So that is written by Julie Gold, who is a Grammy winning songwriter, who is a New Yorker, who also wrote the very beautiful and poetic song From a Distance. Which you may know, which was a Grammy-winning hit sung by Bette Midler. We also, about a third of the songs were written by the Super Simple Songs team.
Yeah, they're fantastic as well.
Who are absolutely terrific. And they came from a classroom in Tokyo. So they were just teaching kids in Tokyo, and they started making, it was the beginning of YouTube, and they started putting up like little cute little videos on YouTube.
Yeah, I saw their stuff, because I mean, I love their stuff and use it extensively, but their whole thing was they filled a hole because they were looking for songs, and they weren't any super simple songs the text that they could follow along. And it's like going back to being creative. They just started doing that, and they're huge now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I was doing a Potato Pals talk in Osaka, and I was wearing a wig, like a Goldilocks wig. I don't know why. I was wearing a sort of a, it was like a Fraulein, and And there was this, we were doing some Potato Pal songs, and there was this guy in the room who was taller than me, which was quite unusual, and yeah, because I'm 6'3". And there was this big guy, and I was like, hey, you know, I went over and I was kind of making fun of, I wasn't making fun of him, but I was making fun of the situation where the two of us were, you know, clearly about a foot taller than everyone else in the room. And that was Devon. So that's Devon Thagard, who he was like, I'm just doing this thing with songs, and I just came along to see, you know, see what you guys are up to. And yeah, that was Devon. And then, so we became friends. And then when Everybody Up came along, I asked him, would he be interested in doing songs for Everybody Up? And he, thank goodness, because it gave us a great, it's a terrific thing to be able to say, Everybody Up has a load of songs written by Super Simple Songs, because everybody, yeah. Not only so are they popular. Very good.
Everyone knows Super yeah. Simple Songs.
And he wrote this song for Everybody Up, which goes like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's great. It's so simple.
Inspired.
It is.
Sorry, Rich, you were going to say something.
I was just interested, what were your sort of priorities when you were composing Everybody Up? Like, what were your, methodological priorities?
I suppose the number one priority and strength of Everybody Up, if I may be so immodest, is structure. So unit structure. And it all comes back to building a really solid unit structure that then you can replicate throughout the series, which follows a pattern, which means that the course becomes easy to teach. Mm. So in Everybody Up, the first thing we did as part of the Everybody Up was very well supported, and we had these amazing author weeks in New York where we'd all get together and get around. And the first thing we did was we looked at all the other books. Mm. And literally we locked ourselves in rooms with piles and piles of every other primary school book. And then we went through them all, and we went through all the words, and we went through all the thing, and where do they teach rhinoceros, and where do they teach the present perfect, and where do they do this, and what do they have, and what? And then there was a survey done of 6,000 teachers.
Mm.
So we got all this information about what people want, what people are doing, and then we looked at big sort of successful courses like Let's Go, and we thought, okay, these courses are doing great. What can we do that sort of moves it on to the next, you know, what's the next generation course book going to have that incorporates all this, you know, understanding of what people need and what people want? And so then we made a unit structure, and then we did some sample units, and then we threw them all in the bin, and then we made some more, and then we tried those out, and we looked at those, and we thought, wouldn't it be better? And we threw those all in the bin. Mm-hmm. And then we eventually ended up with a unit structure which makes sense, which is kind of, you know, it's logical, and yet it's not. I mean, like with all good structures, you don't want to see the structure too much, but you want to know the structure's there. And the structure has to help bring the students from learning some words and, if, you know, and also bringing it up to this wider world connection. So in Everybody Up, lesson one and two are quite traditional, would be very similar in some ways to, you know, they have vocabulary, grammar, vocabulary and context. They build the grammar a bit. And then in lesson three, we take that language and do it in use it in a story. Uh-huh. Language in the story is the language they've learned in the first two lessons, and then that's supplemented with functional language. So, you know, so you've got your story environment, which then goes on into the CLIL lesson, the sort of the real world connection lesson. So, you know, you might have a story where they're at the zoo, and then the next thing you're in the Serengeti with you know, cheaters attacking you.
I really like that. It built and it built logically, and you know, often you get books and it's just kind of like, okay, now we're doing B, now we're going past simple, present simple, but it worked well in that, as you said, it was like you're building, making a cake or building a house. You know, it's layer upon layer, and it kind of, it feels a little bit like magic because you don't really see the structure as much. And I was very interested to hear that you had all the surveys from all the teachers as well, because I'm like, that makes so much sense, because you've, at the very, very beginning, you have the classroom commands, like one of the very first page or something like that. And all the books, I was always, because I always do that on my very first class. That's, you know, teaching classroom commands, doing lots of TPR and dances, Simon Says, just so that they know what I need them to do. But yeah, that integrated into the course book, I was like, this is such a teacher move, but it makes sense.
Well, it's, you know, the course was, a working title for the course, which was New Global Primary. So the idea was we wanted to create, now I'm fully aware that everybody has their own classroom context and their own local context and their own cultural teaching context and so on, but we wanted to create a global course that then everybody in their own place would do their thing with it. But we wanted to celebrate that sort of, you know, there are tens of millions of English teachers in the world all doing teaching primary. You know, this is a wonderful thing to be a part of. And it's a wonderful community. And it's, you know, so we did want to create something that was usable anywhere. And, you know, not just from, oh, we want to sell books anywhere, because actually it's probably easier to sell books if you make them locally relevant. We wanted to do something that was bringing people together all over the world. And the first thing that when the course was launched, we had the Everybody Up Global Sing-Along, which was a song contest, which you can, if you go on YouTube and look up Everybody Up Global Sing-Along now, you'll see, you know, hundreds of teachers all over the world singing the same song. And it was a great thing, you know, it was really lovely to see. So yeah, it has that sort of motivation above everything else.
Have they done a mosaic or like a montage of all the people, the teachers singing that? Because that would be a great idea.
There's playlists. I think there are playlists of the Global Sing-Along entries.
Sounds like another pandemic
special. I made something which was like, yeah, you, next thing you're in Thailand, next thing you're, you know, you're singing you know, I Like Chicken, and then you've got kids. I mean, there was a school in Taiwan and they had the children. There was one poor boy who was covered in ice cream. It was terrific.
That's going to get a lot of engagement in the class, I can imagine.
Yeah, I have the word engagement on my mind at the moment, Neil, because it seems to me that this is also one of your priorities with the book, Patrick. If I think about, you know, first of all, the narrative focus you said was like, it's like the third part, right? And, you know, that's very, like, a narrative focus is very engaging for kids. They love stories. So you take them into this story world, and also the songs. Right. I mean, one of the big things about songs is that kids get into them.
Yeah.
So presumably, I mean, how would you rate sort of engagement in terms of priority? It's one of the things that I feel sometimes gets undervalued.
I think it's everything, isn't it? Isn't it the fundamental, if children are engaged in what is happening in the classroom, if they're not, then... Yeah,
the door's shut, the windows are bolted, right?
What is it? The lights are on, but no, the lights are off. Nobody's in. You know?
Yeah,
something like that. If only we had some English teachers to help us out.
the spark of engagement, yeah, and how to bring that about. I mean, I would say it's number one. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and sometimes, you know, I think people get lost in kind of, you know, language objectives and this sort of thing, right? And that's when, you know, it's like you say, if the kids aren't engaged, it's almost, what's the point?
Yeah.
And I think you can, you know, if you're not, if you can lose a class, or I remember teaching classes that I'd lost, and that feeling of, you know, these guys aren't with me. You know, they'd rather be somewhere else. They don't want to be here. And the mutual feeling in myself that I didn't want to be there either. And that sort of negative spiral that you can get into with a class is easy to happen. And I think, yeah, maintaining the energy. And I think that's why wellness, you know, your own wellness and your own... yeah, just your own spirit is so important when you're a teacher, because you know, tiredness or not really wanting to be there or not really knowing why you're there or not really appreciating that you actually have a really cool job and that you are in a very lucky situation.
Yeah, that's a really important point, I think, and a lot of teachers lose sight of that, especially.
Yeah.
You know, if you're kind of one of those new backpack teachers and you're like, and you move to a place, you kind of realize how lucky you are. I mean, how lucky we are, you know, to just happen to win this genetic lottery and be born in a native English speaking country that, you know, give us this gift that we're allowed to travel elsewhere. Yeah. And
I think it's always important, isn't it, that if ever it feels like, you know, teaching is just becoming a job, then maybe you need to mix it up a bit or try something a bit differently or try a different age group of students, but just anything to kind of invigorate yourself a bit. Because I think, you know, when teaching becomes a job and it becomes kind of, you know, automatic and you're just going in and going through the motions, it's not good.
I think like any job that you'd rather not be doing. I mean, it is very damaging to the soul. Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that, moving on a little bit, I guess, from everybody up in the course books and moving on to Picker Pals, that kind of makes sense with your journey, because you're changing it up and you're taking the classroom, you're kind of moving away from the classroom to the wilder world and kind of bringing the wilder world to the classroom. You know, could we have you start? Talk a little bit about that. And
yes, sure. I love being outside. I love the outdoors. I love walking outdoors. And I moved back to Ireland 12 years ago now. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I was walking where I walk every morning after I dropped the kids at school. And I found this seagull flapping around on the pier, and it was all caught up in fishing line. And there was this sort of semi-comic situation with me and my West Highland Terrier and the fishing line and asking old men for scissors. And, you know, eventually we had to bring it into the local restaurant actually for the chef to free this thing to cut off. And then there was this beautiful moment where the bird was, you know, released into the sky. And just before it was let go, it pecked me very badly on my finger, and there was blood. And, you know, so it was a kind of shocking, you know, 20 minutes. The next morning I went to the same place, and there was a litter picker, like a picker-upper, on the ground.
Oh, okay.
And being a thieving, you know, whatnot, I just thought, oh, well, look, a picker-upper. And some council guy had left it, obviously. So I picked up the picker-upper and I started litter picking as just a thing, you know, and I got really into it. And I, you know, it at a certain age, you know, you develop these obsessions. So every morning I would go down and with my West Highland Terrier, and I would pick up the litter that is all over the coast. And then I'd start finding, you know, most of it's awful rubbish, but every so often you find something really interesting. Mm-hmm. you know, you find something like, you know, a pair of false teeth or a message in a bottle, or if you're a beachcomber, you do actually find really funny and interesting things. So I started a collection, much to my wife's disgust, which was of all these weird things like dolls' heads and bits of seagull bone and sort of. And then I'm involved as a governor of the local school here. So I thought, okay, well, I'll show this stuff to some of the kids down there. Obviously, my desire to teach was overwhelming. So I started arriving at the school with suitcases full of this stuff. And the kids were just went mad for it. They loved it. You know, it was just a different sort of, fantastic energy in the classroom. So then I thought, okay, then it was my niece's 21st birthday party. And it was a fancy dress party, and so I thought, oh, okay, I'll go as some sort of weirdo, shamanistic kind of guy. And so I got a curtain and I attached some of these beach finds to this curtain, and I wore it, and it was like this cape, and it was a hit. You know, everyone was like, oh, that's really cool. You know, it's like, well,
I'll put an image up so people can see this blanket of picked so thing. Cloak,
I actually have it here because I knew you'd.
Wow.
No.
Wow.
That looks like it took a long time.
There's hundreds of pieces on there. It took forever, yeah. So,
Eddie makes, then, I love the noise as well.
So now when I go into the kids, they're like, they really find this quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Sorry. Forgive the rattling. So this sort of grew legs, as is that what you say? The cloak grew legs, and then I don't know. I was thinking about where I've had a sort of a strange life with lots of different aspects to it, mm-hmm. and I was thinking, okay, I've done this and I've done these things, and I thought, well, what's in the middle there? What is the thing that will, make all that I can actually, have some fun with the things I've done so far? And so I came up with an idea to create. Oh, I mean, I thought I'll write some book. I'm a children's book writer. I'll write some books about litter picking. Mm-hmm. So my passion is for litter picking. I'm a writer. Let's write. So I wrote these books, or at least I created some characters called the Picker Pals characters, and they, so they're a completely random selection of, I'll have an aardvark, oh, a sloth, yeah, that's great, we need it. So these are the Picker Pals, and again, yeah, self-publishing in action. So there's, these are characters that go on litter picking adventures and get into all sorts of scrapes. Mm. Books and classroom stuff is one thing, but you've got to actually get the kids doing something. Yeah. So then I thought we need a pack which contains litter picking stuff. So I designed a bag which contains all the stuff you need for litter picking. It has gloves and hi-vis and all the kit and everything. And it's made from recycled sails. And so the schools become Picker Pal schools, and they get all their books and worksheets and all the environmental classroom content, but they also get their picker pack. And then they can go out litter picking in turn. So they take it in turns. Mm-hmm. So it's like a sort of a used, that classroom teddy thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a useful version of that.
I just see so many possibilities with it as well. You know, like the kids, they go and they pick the trash, or they pick the litter or whatever. And then, you know, maybe they find something interesting, and then you set them to write a story. Well, where do you think this came from, and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And then it's personalized.
There's so much learning in it. I mean, and again, I don't want to come across as a complete lunatic, but it's everything for me, because it combines everything. It's got environmental, it's got science, it's got storytelling, because they're going on a litter picking adventure. It's cross-generational. They just love having a job. It gives them a responsibility. It gives them stewardship of their local environment. It connects the school and the classroom to the local, the community. Mm-hmm. And it works. And, you know, people, the teachers love it. And the kids, the highlight of my whole life probably actually was I was in West Dublin and I do a kind of a spiel. Yeah. And I take out the pick-a-pack. It's like the highlight of the thing is taking out the pick-a-pack. And I took out the pick-a-pack and I said, and look, and in there we have a big litter picker a big picker-upper for the grown-ups, and a little picker-up for you guys. And one little boy, he put his hands up and he said, I'm in heaven!
Brilliant.
Because, you know, with kids, you know, my son, he spent about 3 years wearing a Bob the Builder helmet and high vis.
Yeah.
You know, because they love a job, you know, and you're getting a job and you're getting the tools and you're getting a lot of, you know, you're getting a lot of feedback, and you're leading this change in your area. So it's I'm very pleased with it. And now we're in 100 schools in Ireland now. So the next thing is the world. Yeah,
definitely. I can see it being, you know, like everybody up in it being a global thing, definitely. I think it's one of those things with kids as well, where it's, you know, one of those things that they're told not to do. You don't pick up trash, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. then it's a little bit taboo, but you're like, oh, I can do this. And then this is actually interesting. I see a lot of potential and learning potential with that, with classroom, because it leads into so many different things with sciences and such. And yeah, I think it's great. And it's free labor. It's like prison labor.
That is the thing that must not be said, Neil.
No, sorry. I'll cut that out. We'll clap. So we need our point.
Local getting children to pick up their rubbish.
But isn't that a parent's dream anyway, just to get your kids to be doing jobs for you?
Well, it's a kid's dream to be leading.
It's
if you think of all the great children's stories, it's where the children take over control of the situation, and the children are leading the grown-ups. And that's what Picker Pals is. It's the children come. So obviously the parents know that this is going to happen, because you've got sort of letters telling the parents what's going on. But the child will come home and say, I've got the picker pack this weekend. And the competition to get the picker pack, you know, they have to have sort of, the picker pack is kept under armed guard in the classroom, because everybody wants to take it home so much. So you're building this, you're giving them power. That's what, I mean, that, and I suppose that's what tools are. You know, the tools give us power, and you're giving the children the tools and the equipment to, and then they take the grown-ups out.
And there's that agency. Can you give us some details on how schools and teachers can, you know, get more information on Picker Pals?
Yes, we have a website which I will I'll send you the link to, and it's, as I say, it's we're launching worldwide in the near future. So what I'm interested to do is have conversations with people. So yesterday I was talking to a teacher in Italy, where there is some litter, and talking about the cultural sort of aspects. And, you know, it's almost a political thing, she was saying, you know, that some people who are environmentally minded and some people who wouldn't touch it, you know, but that certain clubs would do it or certain groups would do it. And, you know, so that there are all sorts of interesting conversations to be had. I mean, I know Brighton, I'm looking forward to finding somebody in Brighton who might be able to, you know, put me in touch with some good people over there. I don't know if anybody knows anybody.
Well, not so much yet, to be honest, apart from myself. But yeah, no, it's
that's all, what
it's
I was thinking.
Because of the current situation, who knows? You know, who knows when Brighton's going to open up again properly in terms of teaching. Yeah, no, there's definitely different cultural aspects to or cultural ideas on litter, isn't there? I think it's probably a bit more like, you know, we're quite aware of it in sort of the British Isles or Northern Europe in general, right? But I remember when I was living in Spain, I was walking behind a guy in Valencia. The guy took out a cigarette, was like, lights it, and he had his fag packet in one hand, he just tossed it over his shoulder. Like, and I was walking behind him, like the thing almost hit me, you know. I mean, that was, you know, that's the kind of thing that you can see sometimes. Maybe that attitude is starting to change a bit more now, but yeah.
And I think that's why I'm happy to be involved at the age, the age of children we're involved with. It's a fantastic age to be creating a positive, you know, teaching around this kind of stuff, because you're really, you know, I think something happens between, you know, little kids get this, they really do. They get they get the impact on the environment. They get that it's not nice. They get that it's bad behavior. They get that, you know, and so when you give them the opportunity to actually make a difference themselves, I think, you know, we on the brochure of Pick Up Hours, we say, you know, creating young environmentalists. Mm-hmm. So it's not about picking up litter. It's about creating a mindset that is empowering people to think of themselves in a different way regarding the environment. So yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic, and I will be putting up links below here so people can go and, you know, get more information and you know, bring that into their schools.
So one thing that's on my mind, Patrick, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on the future of teaching young learners. Do you have any foresight into where things might be going in, say, 20-30 years?
Oh,
I know, it's a simple question, right?
Can I? Yeah, 20 minutes is. I'm going to finish this cup of coffee, hopefully, and then I'm going to go and walk the dog. There are clearly things that are emerging, and. Obviously, the expectation for interactive, exciting content that is, you know, things are moving fast in that direction, that things are becoming much more, you know, teachers are expecting much more, students need much more in order to be engaged. I would imagine that there will be some incredibly cool sort of gamified learning environments, AR, VR, sort of mixed reality. You know, I think the future of language learning is going to be dramatically different. I think we'll look, in a few years, we'll look at the classroom, take out your book, turn to page 17 kind of vibe as, yeah, even now it's kind of getting a bit dated, but I think that's going to be, you know, We're going to be, there will be storytelling and content and songs and music and dance, but the delivery is going to be different. There's going to be the links to the wider world, actually, you know, the everybody up sort of let's link the classroom to the wider world will be a complete reality.
I think that's why it's that's why I kind of bring that up, because I think going forward, for me, when I look into the future with teaching young learners, I see more connection outside of the classroom, not less. So when I heard you were doing Picker Pals, I was like, moving forward, I see this is, you know, going forward, this has been a fantastic avenue, you know, with schools, you know, being a huge component of that.
Well, the technology, the language for communication, you know, that communication will be a very, I mean, even now it's easy enough, but it'll become more and more easy to have either curated or your more completely real interaction between people. You know, classrooms will be connected in much more interesting ways. Teachers will be supported in much more interesting ways and will be connected in, you know, I mean, I think everything, it's happening. You know, it really is happening. And I think the gap between the home and the classroom will vanish. So, you know, the learning will take place sort of seamlessly. And I think teachers will need to be, people have been saying this forever, but teachers really will need to be, you know, up to speed with this stuff. You know, they'll need to be open to exciting new sort of technologies. But actually, even if they're not open to them, they're going to be using them anyway, actually. So
well, I think that's what we're finding out right now.
Yeah. Well, for sure. Yeah, look at us. Yeah. Really.
Yeah. It's kind of like someone's put some extra tokens into the game machine and they've just turned it onto turbo mode. And then, okay, all that thing that you think is going to be happening 20, 30 years down the line, now it's happening right now. You're not prepared. Oh, sorry.
But it's, I think the you know, last night I was up half the night. I was up half the night making a cardboard box. You know, so you know this was my, you know, and I was there at 1:30 in the morning, and it was Pritt and scissors, you know, the Pritt stick and the scissors and ripping up loads of bits of paper and that sort of activity. Though I think, you know, that's really that's what kids love. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's touching, you know, doing. It's touching things, it's making things, it's sticky, you know, it's that sort of activity. That so there's going to be all this cool stuff, techie cool stuff, and there's going to be a sort of an understanding that actually, you know, real stuff is things. But then when those come together, there's an awful lot of real magic can happen, because you can, you know, you can send your Pritt stick by, you know, through a Zoom call, you know, you can share your Pritt stick with somebody in Cairo and then pass it. But, you know, the sharing of real world experience. Mm-hmm. So it's the real world stuff that matters.
Yeah. You shouldn't worry so much about the technology aspect of it, because the real world will always trump the glitz of that. You know, you can have the most gamified, you know, PowerPoint presentation with all the Avengers and Disney characters out there, but you know, if you just bring in a doll head that you found on the beach and be like, what is the story behind this? I think that's probably going to be something that the kids are going to want to engage with more.
I think actually that's probably one of the big challenges that kind of ELT's had with technology, is actually using it in a useful way, isn't it? You know, and I think because I mean, a lot of technology has been around for a long time now, you know, tablets and stuff like that. And, you know, I remember when me and you first started teaching, Neil, you know, I don't think a lot of classrooms really had any idea what they were doing with it. You know, it was just like, oh, we'll just have the tablet there for the sake of having it there, you know, and that
will work
on its own. I think it's taken a long time really for, you know, teachers to really, to basically know how to use the tools well, I guess. And for different kinds of software to come along, you know.
And to realize it is just a tool as well. It's not just this is not the thing to teach the students. This is not like the magic bullet. It's just another thing that you can pull from your teaching toolbox. The sole idea of engagement and getting your students, your kids, involved in the classroom and excited to be there, it doesn't change.
Yeah. I mean, I remember at secondary school, one of the teachers came in and he held up a silver spoon, a ladle, like an old soup ladle. And he said, look at this. And we were down the back going like, he's gone nuts. He was holding up this ladle. And he was like, no, look. And yes, Jackson, behave yourself. Look. And he showed us this silver ladle, and it was a beautiful ladle. And he showed us the silver mark on the back. And he said, this is how you can tell the age of it. And this is, you can tell where it was made. And then got really into it, told us about, it was in his grandmother's house, and it had been in her grandmother's house. And actually it was Georgian, and then da-di-da, and Georgian. And so he brought this thing, and then he passed it round, and we all sort of, waved it or hit each other with it, or and I can remember that ladle, and and it was 40 years ago, and I can't even remember the teacher. Who was he? I have no idea. I can't remember at all. I presume it was history, but I don't even remember that. But the real object, I think, has much more power than any digital thing. I mean, it's a real thing, it's there, and it's any sort of beautifully presented video of a silver spoon, a documentary about, imagine going in and saying, okay, kids, we're going to show you a documentary today about a Georgian silver spoon. can we get out of here now, sir?
But on the counter to that, if you write it down on paper and you give this to another teacher, be like, okay, here's a silver spoon, and this is my lesson plan for the silver spoon. They might think you're out of your mind, but is that the whole story, the atmosphere, and how you kind of present it, and how it's something important to you.
That's it. Yeah.
Transfers to them. And that's why it's important.
It's passion. It's passion for something. It's passion for something real that does so many things. It works on so many levels, and it gives the teacher, okay, sorry, I forgot who it was now, but at that time he was conveying his passion for a real thing. So when I go into a classroom with the cloak, okay, it's conveying the idea that here's a lunatic who's somehow been let into our classroom. Somebody call the police. But they'll remember, they won't remember my head, but they'll remember the cloak.
Yeah. You've created your own silver spoon moment now.
But it is that, it's about bringing your stuff to your classroom, bringing your thing. Don't just be like, don't be everybody up unit three. Be you and do everybody up unit three, but do it and bring yourself to it. So if it's a, you should be bringing, it's just a structure. A course is just a structure. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. It's just for you to dance on top of it. It's for you to, I don't mean stomp on top of it. Okay. but it's a starting point.
I think that would, I totally agree. And I think that's a great end to the interview, because I know, time's marching on. Rich, do you have any final thoughts, words?
No, very interesting though. I love all this discussion about Realia. The cape is amazing, because I actually haven't used your stuff before in classroom, Patrick, unfortunately.
Lucky man.
So I wasn't that familiar with it, but it's absolutely fantastic. And yeah, the cape is incredible. I can imagine that the idea that all these different things could have a different story or a different, there's so much potential for creativity and whatnot with that. So yeah, fantastic. I don't really have any final kind of questions or anything.
Okay. Then I'm going to give it back to Patrick to give his final thoughts, any final comments that you want to leave with us, any links or anything like that. But before I do so, thank you very much for coming on our show. It's been a fun, I've really enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully at some point, if you ever have time, I'd love to do it again. But over to you, Patrick.
Well, thank you. I've very much enjoyed it as well, and it's very nice to meet you guys. And I'm sure in another world we'll meet up once we get rid of this wretched thing. Final thought would be to start and to bring, you know, to bring. You don't think, am I a sort of creative person or am I X, Y, or Z or whatever? Just start and let that take you on whatever journey it takes you on, because that's when the fun starts. That's when, you know, that's when the magic happens, is when you just start and do it and don't particularly wonder too much about where you're going, but because you'll be going on a fun adventure. And yeah, well, it's lovely to be able to talk to you. And if anybody's listening out there, thank you. Enjoy your journey.
Wonderful, excellent call to action, as they say. So if you're wanting to have seen some of more of my stuff, remember to check out teamteachchina.com, where we've got all our PowerPoint lessons and all our gamification, and Team Teach China on the YouTube for more teaching stuff, Team Teacher Baby for more of our parenting stuff, and Team Teacher English for some other homeschool English lessons. And then we have Mr. Rich.
User.com/professori. if there's any students who happen to be watching this, because that's what that channel's for, and I haven't done a video in a while either, I need to do something like that.
And for Patrick Jackson and Everybody Up and Potato Pals and Picker Pals, all that, I'm going to put links in the description box and in the comments. So we highly encourage that you get yourself over there and, as Patrick said, just get started.